Thank you for downloading this episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on everything software-defined. To get more episodes and explore other SDN and network automation resources, visit sdn.ipspace.net.
A few months ago, we started hearing about these startups that will save the world with programmable ASICs and their new programming languages. So after OpenFlow has evidently failed in most cases and didn't save the world, now we have this new thing that will save the world, and because OpenFlow really failed, they claim, because the old ASICs were too rigid for this brave new world of OpenFlow. And now the programmable ASICs will save the world. Turns out we had programmable network processors for the last 20 or so years, starting with the chipset in the original Cisco 7000 router, the silicon switching engine. And so it's time to dehype that hype and figure out what's real and what's really going on. And we'll try to do that today. And with me is Peter Jones, principal engineer at Cisco Systems. We're recording this at Cisco Live, so the background noise is at the usual levels. You might hear the keynote announcements in the middle. Welcome, Peter.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking the time and chatting about ASICs.
I'm happy to talk about ASICs anytime.
Why would that be?
That would be because after I joined Cisco in December 2005, about middle of 2006, I started working on this new program we're going to build. So I work for the part of Cisco that makes catalyst switching. Mm-hmm. Actually, when I joined, I didn't really know what they made because it was hard to find out. They used to call it DSBU or DISBU, which was the desktop switching business unit. And so this is the people who make catalyst 2K and 3K. Mm-hmm. And so I joined Cisco having been through a few startups, and because I wanted to go somewhere where I could build stuff that got used. So I went through two startups and we built a lot of interesting product and it died. And I found that I really wanted to build stuff that people actually got to use. So
what have you learned in those startups? Why did they die?
I think startups mostly die because they cannot manage or get their product to market, right? There's lots of very cool ideas, but the difference between a cool idea and something that actually is used is a long way. And it's all the boring stuff about actually understanding your customers, getting stuff to market, having it reliable. That's hard, right? So it's very hard.
Solving a problem that someone is actually willing to pay for.
Willing to pay for and has the time to pay for and all those things.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this was around 2006. At that stage, the Catalyst 3750 was just sort of coming onto the market. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was 3750X. And we were looking forward and going, what should we do next? And what we sort of decided was that there was no point in just going faster because that was a race to the bottom. What we decided was we didn't know what was coming next. And so when you decide that, you go, okay, so what do I build? If I'm building fixed hardware, it's just going to do one thing. What things do I believe in? Mm-hmm. And so we actually decided that we would invest in flexibility because we said, we're pretty sure it's going to change. Instead of deciding, hey, we know the future, we said, well, we know the future will change. Mm-hmm. So what we want to do is build something that gives us the ability to roll out new stuff without changing the hardware.
Okay, so on one end, you have the general CPUs.
Sure. Which is where I started writing my networking code. My first networking job was a company in Australia called Datacraft that eventually got bought by Dimension Data. And we built basically protocol converters and terminal emulators and things. So I wrote like a terminal emulator for a Burroughs TD830.
You as well.
Yeah.
I did TN3270.
We did that as well. So our thing was basically anything you like on a VT100.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Which company did you work for?
Oh, I was just a few of us writing code, and then there was someone who was trying to sell that on Atari ST.
All right, so
it didn't go well.
So we did things like Burroughs TD830 terminal emulators and Tomahawk 3270 and SDLC parser and all that sort of stuff. That was all software forwarding on a 68000, right? So written in C.
So that's good enough if you're working at low speeds or if you have too much power to burn.
General purpose CPUs are awesome because you can do anything you like.
Yes.
But the price performance is challenging. Clearly, Intel has moved a long way towards... What's interesting is at one stage we had... Intel is now adding a bunch of optimizations, so it's not really a general-purpose CPU anymore. They can fit a bit extra in. But I think of technology as a little like tidal, right? It's not like a clock because it doesn't always swing the same amount, but it's always going backwards and forwards, right? The flip between how do you accelerate? I mean, remember the RISC and the CISC and who is going to win, and now we just don't care.
Okay, so for listeners who are not old enough to remember
The reduced instruction set computer and the complex instruction set computer. Because at one stage, the theory was you couldn't make a complex instruction set go very fast So they made very simplified instruction sets so they could make them go quicker.
You would do five instructions instead of one complex one, and you hope that you would still come ahead because you are so much faster.
Sure. You know, you see this all the time, that technology advances in some areas and then balances out and evens up. I mean, that was the whole... It was MIPS and it was PowerPC.
So PowerPC was RISC,
PowerPC
right?
was, yeah. And, MIPS,
and X86 MIPS, was CISC.
Yeah, it was CISC.
And we know how that ended.
Actually, well, in the fact, we don't care how it ended, right?
Exactly.
Now, if you actually go and look at what the X86 is doing, it does all sorts of very interesting things. But just like if I get in... So I recently bought a Leaf as a car. I actually don't care how it works because I get in and I do the steering wheel, right, and it just works the same. The fact that it's an electric motor instead of a gas engine, it just means I plug it in instead of put gas in.
Yeah. Okay, so back to switching.
Back to switching.
We had generic purpose CPUs doing packet forwarding. People are still doing that today, and they got to ridiculous speeds, like hundreds of gigabits on a few CPU cores. I actually know people who do 20 gig per core.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's also, that's a big Intel hot thing, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, you have to optimize the clock cycles.
You have to run the clock cycle.
Yeah, and they're optimizing the cache population.
And about how much is that CPU costing?
A few $100.
Okay.
Yeah, I know.
And it does 20 gig.
Well, I had that discussion. Well, it does more because it's a multi-core CPU and so on. They do 20 gig per core.
Okay. That's a good number.
Yeah. But I had exactly that discussion with a hardware manufacturer, and they were doing 1 gig switching with radio uplink.
Okay.
And I said, well, why do you bother? Why don't you just take an Intel CPU and you can get the throughput you need?
Sure, but if it's they're doing 1 gig with a radio uplink, then it's probably a pretty small box. And the Intel chipset becomes expensive, and they probably want to run it at about 3 watts.
And that's why they said, we can get the Intel chipset for like $300 or so, and we can get what we have now for less than $50. So...
I mean, so... If you think about it, Intel has not had a great success in the smartphone market, right? They've been in there a few times, but ARM wins. ARM wins because you can customize what you want and build the ecosystem around it. Because at the small market, it's all about integration. I mean, how did you get the right functions at the right price performance?
So with ARM, you effectively buy the design and then you tweak the design to your own needs and then you do your own chips, right?
Yes, you can do that. I mean, you can also buy them from other people. Like, you can buy them from many manufacturers that will sell you a bunch of ARM cores with stuff around it, right? So Marvell will sell you that, Cavium will sell you that, lots of people will. But you can also license the core yourself. So if you're the big high-end smartphone guys, they probably just license them themselves, which means they get to choose what goes in them.
Yeah.
And if you look, for a while the ARM was, they were arguing that they had significantly better performance per watt.
Probably, yeah. Lower speed, higher performance per watt.
Per watt, yes. Yeah. Which, if you're building a DC, is sort of interesting. But I think the DC people at the minute have decided they'd prefer to go Intel and just cool everything. So I guess you go and build your data center in Reykjavik.
Somewhere nice and cold. Well, some people are doing that.
Free cooling. Back to switching?
Back to switching. Yeah. So on the total other end of the spectrum, you have fixed configuration silicon.
Yep.
That can do layer 2 and layer 3 forwarding and
can do lots of
simple
things.
Packet filtering.
But it does those jobs. And those jobs only, which is awesome if you know what you're going to need.
Once you burn the silicon, it cannot do anything else. And if you got it wrong, you have to fix the silicon and reburn the silicon. And then VXLAN comes out and you go like, oh, shit.
Okay. Yes, it's like bugger.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, why do we call those things ASICs?
An application-specific integrated circuit.
Okay, so the application is some packet forwarding.
Well, I mean, that's an example of an ASIC. But I could build you an ASIC that did a radio. I could build you an ASIC that did... data compression, right?
So why don't we call memory chips ASICs?
Well, you actually could, but I guess they're specifically, there's enough of them that they're just known as memory, right?
Okay.
You know, between DRAM, flash, everything else, yes, they are an application. So what you tend to say is people who build specific smaller things for a certain task. And so usually,
so if you have small series for specific tasks, you call that ASIC.
Yes.
And if you build enough of them, you call them memory chips or CPUs.
A product, yes.
Yeah.
Well, yes, and you could think of a general-purpose CPU as a specific application to a general-purpose CPU. So, I mean, ASIC in general is I want this to do a particular task.
Mm-hmm.
Now, memories, they do a task, they store stuff, but we have no idea what it is. Now, if you think about then when you build memories, do you build them as DRAMs or SRAMs or everything else, right? So there's lots of different ways to build memories.
Okay, now that you went down that path, what's the difference between DRAM and SRAM?
Speed and cost.
Okay. Behind the scenes?
This is where you get into the stage, I'm not actually an ASIC guy. Okay. So I know that DRAM generally is much higher density and runs much slower.
Okay.
So, for instance, in most of our silicon that we build, mm-hmm. we don't have DRAM inside it. We have SRAM.
Because DRAM is too slow DRAM for the things you have to do.
Yes. Again, the speeds change over time. Like DRAM is getting faster. SRAM is getting faster. There are new RAM technologies coming out all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are doing all sorts of very interesting things. People combine. If you need a lot of memory that's on an ASIC, what they'll often do is they'll actually package another die on top of it. Mm-hmm. So they'll have a forwarding part of the die. Mm-hmm. They'll have the memory as a separate chip on the top.
But it's a separate chip glued onto the top of the other chip.
Yes, multi-chip module or something similar.
So that's very similar to what IBM was doing decades ago with their ceramic module, right?
So you've figured out that actually there aren't that many new ideas in the world and we just keep iterating on them?
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. So coming back to the forwarding spectrum, we have CPUs on one end, we have fixed switching chips on the other end, and then somewhere in the middle is something called the NPU. Mm-hmm. What's that?
So I think there's actually two classes of them.
Mm-hmm.
One class is basically a highly customized CPU.
Mm-hmm.
So you could think, for instance, there was a chip called CPort that was like that. And basically it was a bunch of MIPS cores, right, mm-hmm. with a customized interconnect. And to some extent, that's really what Intel is building now. It's building a variation of NPU because that's all of the data acceleration they have on it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go the other path, there's a bunch of things that were much, much closer to a hardware engine. Things like an accelerated NPU that mm-hmm. was from, or June Networks had one, or even EasyChip.
Oh, I was thinking about EasyChip, yeah.
And they're much lower level. So mm-hmm. I actually liked Accelerator because Accelerator was a data flow pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So so some of them are run to completion, mm-hmm. which is you just work, right? And if you do too much work, right, you just go subline rate. Some of them are actually defined latency. But basically, NPUs are an attempt to give you some of the flexibility of a CPU, but at reasonable performance.
So instead of doing packet lookup by writing the hash table lookup routine, you would have an instruction to do
field lookup. It depends. There was lots of different ways of doing it, and almost the technology business built all of them,
mm-hmm.
right? And some of them succeeded and some of them didn't. So some of them would have dedicated engines, like they might have a hash engine.
Mm-hmm.
Others of them would just have instructions that made it easier to do things. And so Cisco sells all of these, right? We've probably sold every variety under the sun.
And where would you find them in Cisco products?
So Cisco products today, so the lowest end switches like the Catalyst 2K,
mm-hmm.
that's fundamentally fixed function ASIC.
Mm-hmm.
The Catalyst 3K, the 3850s, this is the product I worked on for a long time. We are now a programmable ASIC, so we can actually do some extra work in it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you would see things at the top end like the ASR1K,
mm-hmm.
which uses a chip they're calling the Quantum Flow Processor.
What's that, by the way?
It's an awesome code name.
Yeah.
I mean, what would I class it as? I'd class it as an NPU, because what they have is they have a bunch of cores. I don't remember what they are. They're customized cores that are built, and but you write the code for that in C. So they have customized cores, and they have some extra instructions for doing things like memory allocation mm-hmm. or memory updates. But you write code like you would write it for a normal CPU, just runs faster.
So in that case, they would have additional instructions for things that are...
Atomic memory updates.
Yeah, and things that are expensive to do in software.
Yeah, and so they have a lot of hardware assist for doing things like queuing and buffering, right? So all of the queuing and buffering is handled by someone. But the basic forwarding lookups and stuff is all in software. But you tune that code very carefully to make sure it works nicely. You put the right instructions in the right place. But people can basically write their code like it's C. Now, you can run that same code. You can run it on a normal CPU.
That thing has numerous cores, so it can process numerous packets in parallel, packet per core.
Yeah, they do a bunch. So the ASR1K with QFP, they actually have hardware assist to make sure packets don't get out of order.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the problems if you're doing the multi-core thing and you start spraying packets around,
mm-hmm.
right, misordering them is bad.
You reorder them,
It's not only misordering is bad, but if let's imagine you're doing something that is context-aware, like you're tracking application visibility.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the fourth packet goes first, then you actually miss the signature.
Yeah, and then there's the problem with TCP performance going down when you get reordered.
Ignore for a second the fact that reordering you're not supposed to do. If you are trying to program things in sequence and they go into different cores, you end up with a lot of problems with synchronization.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to do things like make sure a certain flow goes to one core and keep everything in order. And so you can build hardware primitives for that make it easier.
So you would have like a flow sprayer at the front to make sure that packets of the same flow always end on the same core.
Then you have a sequencer on the way out to make sure that packets leave in about the same order they came in.
Yeah, unless they're requeued, which is then a different story.
Well, sure.
Yeah. Okay, so that was NPUs, and we had fixed ASICs, and you mentioned programmable ASICs.
Sure. So
what's the difference between programmable ASICs and NPUs?
Really, the amount of flexibility in price performance.
Okay.
So traditionally, I'm making up some numbers, right? If a fixed function ASIC was cost you $10, right? A somewhat programmable ASIC might cost you $15, mm-hmm. but an NPU might cost you $50.
Because of the increased flexibility.
Increased flexibility, which you have to pay. And whereas a full CPU at the same speed is probably costing you $100. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a question of where you trade off your investment up front. Mm-hmm. If I have a fixed function ASIC, I define exactly what it's going to do. I build that code, I verify it, I'm done. But as you said, right, if I have to change what I need to do, that's hard. Yeah. When you're building flexible ASIC, you have a different question. It's like, where should I spend my money? Mm-hmm. And so the product family I work on, right, we've gone for flexible ASIC. We launched it in the market in 2013. So I agree, like Barefoot Networks, these guys are very excited, right, this new programmable thing. But as you pointed out, right, we've been down this path before. What you tend to find is we'll leak towards more programmability, mm-hmm. and then someone will say, I need it really fast, and we'll go back to more fixed. Then we'll leak towards programmability, and we'll go back to fixed, and we'll cycle around. And of course, a startup's job is to build something new. Yeah. If they don't build it new, then they have no reason to exist.
Or they try to present it as something new that was never invented before, even though a few people in the industry know different. I'm not picking on anyone in specific. I'm just curmudgeon.
Remember, that is their task, right? Their task is to go and try and figure out new ways to do things, which is why most of them fail, right? I mean, if it was easy, everyone would do it and they wouldn't need a business.
True.
So, at a very basic level, there's companies like Cisco, which we do a lot of internal innovation, but we've basically, we build the network for most people. Mm-hmm. Then there's companies who are trying to do something new, right? And so we buy a lot of companies we think are interesting, and we do a lot of internal development. Someone could become the next Cisco. I mean, that's some stuff works and some doesn't. But when someone is out selling, it's because they believe it's right. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean it is.
Okay, coming back to hardware.
How
do you make an ASIC programmable or flexible?
Well, first is we get a lot of little hamsters. We put the hamsters inside the ASIC, right, as they're going around the wheel, right, and then we try and give the hamsters instructions to do different things.
Okay. And you're using silicon hamsters.
Silicon hamsters. Well, actually, they're virtual hamsters.
Okay.
Okay. That way we can instantiate lots of them.
So I've seen the presentation yesterday in the TechField Extra event.
Do you want me to be serious? Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, you weren't serious.
I thought this was a comedy podcast. Are we doing that later?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so let's be serious. So I'm currently talking about an ASIC that we call UADP, right, mm-hmm. which it's not my favorite title, but it's the Unified Access Data Plane. The internal code name is Doppler, and if you see the ones I give around, they actually have both those names on them. So if you think about it, we're basically building the forwarding plane for a 3850 switch mm-hmm. in a chip. Right? So it has buffers, it has memories, it has forwarding controllers, queuing, scheduling, lookup memories, stack interface, everything is in there. And so there's effectively two sections of it. There's what we call a data path section, which mm-hmm. is where the packets flow, and we do buffering and queuing mm-hmm. and scheduling. That's pretty fixed, right? It's configurable. Then we have the forwarding controller, which is where we actually deal with all interesting things with packets.
Ah, so the queuing and dropping stuff is pretty much fixed.
Yeah.
Because that hasn't changed in the last 20 years.
It does actually change, but it's just got to be really fast.
Ah, okay.
So, I mean, you were talking earlier, people were giving 20 gig on a core. So when we first released the system in Cisco Live in London in 2013, the chip we then had was a 56 gig chip. Mm-hmm. So... I have one in front of me, so your listeners can clearly look and see the chip that I'm holding in front of the microphone.
It's very obvious on the recording. Yeah. Looks nice.
Yeah. So this was a 56 gig chip, mm-hmm. and so that was 56 gig at that's packets in and out at 64 mm-hmm. byte frames with all the lookups and everything else, line rate by definition, and it stuck on.
So it's not marketing math.
No,
it's really 56 gig.
It's really 56 gig. That's a packets per second number mm-hmm. at 64 bytes, mm-hmm. and it also that was so it could take. If you pinned out the front, you'd look at it as 24 by 1 gig plus 2 by 10, mm-hmm. plus we allow 10 gig for recirculation, plus we allow 2 gig for the CPU. Mm-hmm. And the back end of that basically connects into a 240 gig stack. Now, the version that we're selling today, that was 2013. The version we're selling today is up to about 144 gig, I think. Mm-hmm. And again, they're actually their line rate performance at all features packet sizes, which is sort of different to most CPUs. They will do some statistics. They'll say, mm-hmm. I'll be line rated about here, mm-hmm. but they'll slow down. So, for instance, most of those systems will have a big buffer in front of the forwarding mm-hmm. to absorb burst. In these system chips here, we basically have no buffering before our forwarding.
So you are forced to do forwarding at line rate because there's no slack.
That's what we designed it for. Mm-hmm. Now, that trend is changing a little bit. The data center, you're seeing people who are now... So, traditionally, the Catalyst 2K and 3K was line rate 64 bytes. That's morphing a little bit. The data center is getting towards the line rate 180 bytes. And so, you know, things move around a little bit, and it really depends what you're willing to pay for. There's branding, right, and there's tradition, and there's what people actually want to buy. But the key point is, so we build our systems to basically run high performance at all features. So that system, I mean, you saw it yesterday. I assume you'll put a link in the do you have show notes or something?
Yeah, I will add the link.
Okay. There's a more animated version of that one from Cisco Live in Europe last year with a friend of mine that I co-present with. But basically we have 15 programmable stages. So the pipeline is like this. The packet shows up. We basically make sure that while the packet's streaming into the buffer, we basically run the first 256 bytes through the forwarding controller. So we run it into a parser. So normally in a fixed system, the parser...
So you would stream the packet into the buffer, but at the same time you would copy the first 256 bytes into a separate pipeline and do parsing of those 256 bytes to extract things like MAC address, IP address, IPv6 extension headers, things like that.
Yeah, all that craft.
Okay.
Yeah, all the stuff you care about.
Okay. So now you have the packet in the buffer and you have the copy of the packet headers in the forwarding pipeline.
Yeah. So
now what?
So the packet in the buffer is just hanging around waiting.
Yeah.
So what I do is I basically take the front of the packet and I pull it apart into the things I care about. Now, if in the fixed function ASIC, you pull it apart based on what you knew about. In ours, we actually have that under software control. So if someone invents a new header, right, I can probably go and just rewrite my parser. And what I do is I basically extract the fields I care about and I put them on a bus, right? We call it the packet state vector, the PSV. And so now what I have is I have this big wide bus and now I throw the packet away inside the forwarding controller. So now I have all these fields that are flowing down my pipeline.
So you are throwing away the non-interesting fields.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I come in with a bunch of bytes. I need to extract them into fields. Then I don't need the bytes anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you said, you'll get MAC addresses, you'll get VLAN headers, you'll get IP flag, TCP flags, UDP stuff, GRE, whatever you want. So now you have the packet split apart. Now you have to do lookups on it. So traditionally with a lookup, what you have to say is, well, I need to do this lookup. I need to form a key. I need to launch a lookup. I get some results from the lookup, we'd call associated data. I'll resolve it, and then I'll keep going. So those for us are also configurable, both the order of lookups, what's in the key, what's in the associated data, and the resolution. So for instance, on a MAC address, we'll do both a source and destination MAC address lookup. We'll do a source and destination IP address lookup. You might have to do a couple of them for multicast. So for us, those are all under software control, and we can change the order and what goes in them.
So in the fixed ASIC...
The fixed pipeline.
Fixed pipeline, you would, for example, do let's look up the destination MAC address. If it's not me, then let's look up the destination MAC address in the MAC table and let's forward the packet.
Sure.
And if it's me, then let's look up the destination IP address. And if that's me, I'll punt to the CPU. And if that's not me, then I hope.
Well, but even if that's you, you may actually do tunnel termination. So you need to split whether it's a tunnel termination
well,
or a punt to CPU.
Yeah, we're not there yet. But yeah, you're right. Whereas in your case, you could, for whatever reason, say, let's do IP lookup first. Let's not even look at MAC addresses. We want to have a pure layer 3 switch that will only do forwarding based on layer 3 addresses, and we'll ignore this whole MAC stuff.
We could.
Well, you're not, because there are people who still rely on layer 2, but
yeah,
you could.
We could. That would just be we would change the way we use their stages.
Yeah. Or you could say, well, I will only look at the MPLS labels. I don't care about the MAC headers if the packet has an MPLS label.
So I'm glad you mentioned that. So when we were working on developing this product, so back in 2007, 2008, right, we were arguing as to whether MPLS was a requirement for the platform. And I knew a little bit about MPLS, not that much. So I got assigned to go read the PRG and go write how would we write it. And doing MPLS really well is actually really hard.
Particularly doing unlimited label stacks, yeah.
And actually not very interesting for a lot of people. And so the split, what we're having trouble with was how do you do just enough MPLS but not too much? Anyway, so at that time, basically MPLS became not a required feature for our platform, right? So we just didn't think about it very much. And part of the problem was that the code train we were on didn't have all the MPLS stuff in it, and it was a huge amount of work to get it there.
So the control plane didn't have the MPLS stuff, so why bother?
Yeah, and it's like, so what actually happened within the last year, someone came up and said, look, we really need MPLS for a bunch of government customers. Now, because...
Oh, surprise, surprise.
Because they need a virtualization technology they consider standard.
Yeah.
And so we didn't actually need all of it. We didn't need all of MPLS, right?
We didn't need the fast reroute and traffic engineering and all that stuff.
Well, we needed some. And so... because Cisco has been doing some consolidation of code chains, of code trains, we now had that stuff available.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically took a couple of people and they went off, they added MPLS to this in a couple of months. So we're now shipping MPLS in the product. So when we launched it, MPLS was a non-requirement. But as a software upgrade, MPLS became available a year ago or so. Mm-hmm.
This is the 16-something train, right?
Yeah.
By the way, as I was somewhat familiar with MPLS back in my days,
mm-hmm.
what can you do on the MPLS front? Let's start with the control plane first.
So I'm not following this in gory detail. So I think when we first started, that someone said, layer 3 VPN only. Right?
Yeah, of course.
Point to point.
That's obvious.
And they said, that's all you want? That's all we want. All right, so then, oh, I think I need layer 2. And now I really need multicast.
Oh, my. I'm so sorry.
Given who we are, you're always better to say, yes, I can do that, but there's this other choice that's better.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to persuade a customer that the thing they believe they really need, because we sold it to them, they don't need, is hard.
What you want to say
is yes, we have that, but here's a better thing you could do.
Mm-hmm.
That's much better than saying, no, 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 no. The guy who came to talk to you last year was just wrong.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You can't do that as a vendor. I can be grumpy.
Sure. We are the major vendor. Our competition will attack anywhere we have a weakness, and so we tend to have to defend everywhere.
Yeah. On the data plane.
On the data plane.
You can be ingress LSR, you can be egress LSR, you can be transit, I guess, do label swapping.
Yes, LSR is easy, I can be an LER as well.
Yeah. How long can the label stack be? How many labels can you push and pop?
How many could we or how many do we?
How many could you?
Could do like 7 or 8. I think we only set up to do about 3 or 4.
Because no one ever needed more.
So because it's a resource trade-off, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I built this purely to be as an MPLS switch, mm-hmm. I would do it differently.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just a thing we do on top of everything else. So at the same time, you know, we have one code load that does L2 forwarding or layer 3 forwarding, V4 or V6, does GUI tunneling, does MPLS, does VXLAN.
Ah, so you only have this many resources in your pipeline, and so you can only do this many reasonable things at the same time.
So, I mean, this is the common problem with NPUs, right? How many things can you do at once, right? You can do anything you like. You can't do them all at the same time.
Yeah.
So far, we've actually done pretty well by killing stuff that we didn't need.
Mm-hmm.
We actually still only have one code load. I mean, if I got really silly, I could end up going and doing different code for like a campus versus a branch versus a SP versus a somewhere else.
Ah, so right now you still have only one version of the forwarding pipeline. Wow. So you have 15 stages there.
15 on ingress, 7 on egress.
So what goes into those 15 stages? You don't have to list all 15 of them.
So the big ones are, you know, the layer 2 and layer 3 forwarding.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that quite early in the pipeline. That's stage 1 and stage 2. And we basically, you know, do the straight simple lookups of MAC source, MAC destination, IP source, IP destination. If it's multicast, then you have to do another IP lookup.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'll have, we have a stage which is basically doing for span.
Mm-hmm.
So basically it's
the... Oh, yeah, span has to be done separately.
Span has to be done separately. So we have a lot of interesting combinations. So we optimize for simple cases. So for instance, if you're spanning to the port, we don't do that with a lookup. So we have this thing called a logical entity, right, which is basically a policy target.
Mm-hmm.
So policy targets, we have a port, VLAN, layer 3 interface. We also have one which is client/group.
Mm-hmm.
So these are 4 different dimensions of policy. So we actually can produce span sessions on all of them without actually doing any software lookups. But then I have another stage where I actually do a full TCAM lookup. So I can do basically policy. If I just want to span a port, I don't need a separate lookup for that.
So you don't burn forwarding stage if you're doing span.
Because I've optimized for the simple cases.
Yeah.
And so then
whereas if you want to span HTTP traffic going to this particular server, you burn TCAM and you burn lookup stage.
Yes. And so lookup stage is configured. I just don't use it for most of the simple cases. Mm-hmm. And so in that particular case, so that's our stage 4, we call it F-span. What we actually do is our system supports 8 span sessions,
mm-hmm.
but a packet could actually go in all 8 of them at once. Right? Because I could have selected one span based on this one, but span based on that.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually, because we build our own systems, we have some interesting TCAM tricks. So what we do is we basically take, I think we have one block is probably 512 entries, and we split it down into 8 regions.
Mm-hmm.
So each region basically contributes one bit to the result.
Ah, interesting.
Right, it's because I have 8 sessions, and then I accumulate the whole lot coming back. So I do one lookup, and I get basically 8. I get effectively 8 bits of result coming back.
And that corresponds to the bit mask to which span sessions this packet has to be sent.
Correct.
Cool. Nice trick.
It is a nice trick.
Yeah.
But it means, you know, if I did it in traditional TCAM, I would have to basically do what they call a merge,
mm-hmm.
and I have to expand that all out. That, so we try not to do merging, right? We try and basically we put in tricks to try and make so we don't ever have to do that software merge because that explodes the number of entries.
Yeah.
So if you're doing...
Cartesian product, right?
Hmm?
Cartesian product.
Yeah. And so if you're doing some systems, like a 6K traditionally, lots and lots of TCAM. So they'll just do a merge and they wouldn't care, right? But I'm a small system with all my memories inside my ASIC, so I don't want to do that. So we do a lot of tricks to try and make our utilization more efficient.
So...
Okay, so we did SPAN. So after SPAN, we'll do security ACLs and QoS. So these are both basically policy lookups, right? We put them in the same lookup stage because we generate single wide keys. For policy lookups, our single wide key is 56 bits and a double wide is 512. So for instance, the V6 will end up going in 512-bit wide key.
Yeah.
So what we can actually do with that stage is basically we put QoS and ACL in the same stage because the keys are almost all the same. And so basically they share a 512-bit wide key. They launch into two different lookup engines. And I get two results back.
Packet drop would just be a special QoS case of drop everything, right?
Packet drop for security or packet drop for policing?
Yeah, packet drop for security.
Okay, so we actually produce we produce two bits. We produce a deny route and a deny bridge. Okay, because I might have to drop it, the layer 3 version, but forward the layer 2 version.
Ah, okay.
And that's different for a policing drop.
Yeah, of course, because there you have to measure.
Okay, so we'll come through basic L2L3 forwarding, SPAN, security and QoS. Then we actually have a TCAM lookup where we fire NetFlow, right? So this is actually lookup to decide what sort of NetFlow you should do.
Ah, okay.
Because, I mean, NetFlow, again, is a policy filter. Like, what do I want to capture?
Yes.
And what thing do I want to do? Because you might be doing microwave policing, you might be trying to catch the fire tackle, you might just be doing something else. So we actually fire a TCAM lookup to go and decide what two NetFlow things will do. Then that result goes down to another stage, which connects to a NetFlow engine.
Which then builds
actually
the
does the work. So basically, we have this pipeline of stages. The stages basically, what they do is they launch lookup requests and they get back answers. And so in the middle of our system, we basically have lookup engines. We have an FSE, which is a FIB search engine, and an ASE, which is an ACL search engine. But also, policers and NetFlow sit in there and pretend to be search engines. So they get a key launched to them and they give me a result.
Ah, so the whatever bucket policer pretends to be a lookup engine.
Yes.
You send it the keys, and instead of doing the lookup, it actually measures and calculates tokens and everything, and then it says, yeah or no.
Basically, it'll give me back a keep or drop. It'll give me back a markdown. Eventually, it'll give me a QoS label. So what we do for QoS is we map everything into an 8-bit label. And so for us, that's internally, everything runs with an 8-bit label. So, we'll assign 64 values for DSCP, 8 values for the other things. And so, what the policer does is it basically it changes a QoS label to another QoS label.
What do you do you could do a
single bucket or a dual bucket.
And what do you do in the output stage? You have like 7 stages in the output forwarding pipeline.
Egress ACLs, egress QoS, egress NetFlow, egress SPAN.
Yeah.
So Catalyst 3K we call it split grain forwarding, right? Because normally we do most of our work on ingress, but then we deliver to the egress and we do the final bit of our work on egress, right? And Cisco has built switches that do every which way, right?
Yeah.
We built all varieties under the sun, but this is basically our design essentially is that we do ingress work, we put a packet on a shared media bus we call a stack, and we do egress work. So we do ingress forwarding, some temporary stage queuing, our main egress queuing, then egress forwarding, and the packet goes out the port.
So you're doing all the lookups and everything and max hop calculation and everything on ingress?
Ingress, we get our result will be a destination index, which defines the set of packet pods that's going out, and a rewrite index that defines the rewrites. So the rewrites are actually done on ingress.
This would be rewrite MAC address or packet
GTL.
Tunnel encapsulation, MPLS labeling position, things like that.
Things like that. So, I mean, remember, so if I'm multicasting, I may have to, the single packet may get multicasted both at L2 and L3. So at L2, it's going to go on ports with different VLAN headers. On L3, it's going to go with different destination MACs.
So that also means that your system could easily do head-end replication for VXLAN if needed, right?
Yeah, actually it does.
Oh, okay. Oh, so tell me about that. What do you do with VXLAN on these switches today?
Okay, warning, right? I have an idea about what's going on, but go and check whether it's actually there. I believe we have, we're currently calling the thing Campus Fabric. There's a bunch of sessions on Cisco Live. So we're starting to see interest in taking some of the lessons from the data center and applying to the campus. Because if you think about it, right, administering a campus is painful. and we want to try and make it easier. Now, we're not a DC, but some of those ideas are helpful. So there's a whole theme about now trying to build an underlay, which becomes stable, and basically delivering services over the top of it. So I think the first tunneling we released was probably GRE. Then we did MPLS. Oh, when we released, we were doing CAPWAP as well, because we had the integrated wireless story. And from my point of view, a tunnel is defined by what's in it, right? Mm-hmm. So VXLAN is a L2 tunnel, because what's inside is layer 2, whereas LISP is a layer 3 tunnel. Mm-hmm. But I don't really care. I mean, I can cover both. What am I doing with it? Mm-hmm. Thinking about how to build an easier campus, because you want to be able to basically have an underlay and carry different services over across the top of it, right? Because IP subnetting is a pain, particularly with wireless. Now, if you think about it, the campus has changed because everyone's bringing their own stuff and wandering around. Mm-hmm. So the idea that an IP address actually tells you where you are anymore is very painful.
Yes.
So I think what you're seeing is people are trying to evolve the network mm-hmm. to make it more useful. And that's sort of a big part of what that's my current thing at the minute, is I've become a network evolution geek, because most of our customers have a network mm-hmm. and they don't get to build new ones very often. And so you've got to figure out how to make the network get better without actually replacing it from scratch. Because in a data center, potentially, I mean, you could imagine, I need to rethink my data center, so what I'll do is I'll move all the workloads to this other data center over there and I'll rebuild this one from scratch.
It doesn't happen.
In theory, it happens, right?
Yeah. But,
you know, the Amazon guys think they do it.
Yeah. Okay, well, I know people who do something like that.
But think about the same thing. Okay, so I have this building, and I've got a lot of people working in the building, and I need to upgrade it a little bit. So let me just clone all of the VPs and put them somewhere else. I'll destroy these VPs. It doesn't work, right?
No.
You basically have to, it's like you have to be able to upgrade the car while it's running. Mm-hmm. And so the question, I think, for us is, how do we make that task easier? Because all the people we sell to have a day job. The day job is running a network to make money. If we make our technology hard to consume, it won't be consumed. So I think that we are getting better at trying to make technology adoptable, mm-hmm. which is the key to success. So we are thinking, and there's a lot of people who talk to this in more detail, you should talk to some of them, that taking some of the lessons from the DC is going to make it easier to run the campus.
Agreed.
Because we can basically get a reliable L3 underlay, mm-hmm. and then we can put stuff over the top of it. Now, it will be taking the lessons from the DC and changing them. So I don't want to build the spine leaf, because I just don't have, I mean, that's not the wiring. And people do not want to rewire campuses.
No, but you do build leaf and spine. It's just you only have two switches in the spine.
Not really, because... And I usually have three levels, right? I have three levels, because that's how we build buildings. Maybe even four levels.
Yeah.
The connectivity is very different. I'm usually oversubscribing a lot more. And my function is different, right? In a data center, you often trust everything that's plugged in. Mm-hmm. In a campus, I trust nothing.
True. Coming back to the programmable ASICs where we started...
Yes.
So the real beauty of that stuff is that whoever comes up with this idea, like, let's use VXLAN because whatever, you can say, well, my ASIC can do that.
Okay. They will say, hey, could you do this? And it's like, yeah, I think so. Like, what exactly do you want me to do? And I say, here it is, and I go take a look. And so, for instance, for us, between LISP and VXLAN is no great issue. Things like GP, when it comes along, will be fine for us. The network services header will be fine, we believe. Do you remember a thing that Cisco did called SIA, the Service Insertion Architecture?
I remember it being talked about.
And then it became, what was it called? There was another name for it. They actually released it in the data center or something else. Something path. It wasn't fabric path. Service chaining of some sort.
Yeah, it was something path.
Yeah, and then...
running on Nexus 1000B.
Yeah. And then it's become NSH is the current usage. Mm-hmm. So those sorts of things we planned for a long time ago to carry metadata around. That's okay, but then you get things like Geneve, which are not so good. You mm-hmm. familiar with Geneve?
I know it exists. I always wondered why, but...
I think Geneve is nice because you can handle almost infinite metadata between two end devices.
Okay.
But that's not very helpful for the network. It's helpful for a host.
Yeah, it's definitely not helpful if you need to forward on that TLV.
Yes. TLVs are okay as long as they're constrained. But as I said earlier, I mean, we do 256 bytes in the packet. I think Geneve, you can have 500 bytes of metadata at the front.
Yeah, that's so useful.
Well, it depends what you're building, right?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, if your job is to make the, if your task is to make the network dumb and put all the brains on the edge, it's an awesome idea.
Yeah.
If your task is to try and make the network help, not so good.
Okay, so let's wrap it just here. If people want to find you and learn more about the programmable ASICs, how can they find you?
I'm pretty active on Twitter. Handle is Peter G. Jones. Mm-hmm. I'm also on LinkedIn. In the easiest, look at Twitter, Peter G. Jones, and just follow me from there. Can you put a link in the show notes or something?
Of course.
Awesome. And yeah. Reach out.
And there are tons of presentations on Cisco Live, so go and explore. and there will be a few videos from Tech Field Day Extra event from Cisco Live Europe. So go and watch those. Anything else?
Sure, we should do this again, because we only got through like a quarter of the topics.
We'll definitely do it again. Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you for your time. It's been a great pleasure.
I feel honored.
And you've been listening to Software Gone Wild. I'm Ivan Pepelniak, and if you want to know more about what I'm doing, just go to ipspace.net and explore.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Software Gone Wild. If you want to learn more about software-defined networking, network automation, and related topics, visit sdn.ipspace.net and explore our courses, books, webinars, and podcasts.